Nice to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to salute the historical, cultural, and geographic riches of our Badger State next as we visit with Mark Van Els. Mark has written one of the on-the-road histories, this one, the state of Wisconsin. He's a native of our state, received his Ph.D. in history from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he, it's, by the way, his on-the-road histories, Wisconsin, is part of a series from Interlink Publishing. He is an associate professor of history at Queensborough College, Community College of the City University of New York, and is the author of another book, To Hear Only Thunder Again, America's World War II Veterans Come Home. But today we're going to zero in on his book about Wisconsin. I finished reading it last night and enjoyed it very much, and I think you will too. And I'm looking forward to visiting with him, and certainly looking forward to your questions as well. If you'd like to join in as we talk here, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Mark Van Els with us by phone. Mark, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
No problem at all.
I really appreciate it. Who's your book for?
The book is for the sort of cultured automobile traveler in, from all the states, in this particular case, Wisconsin. It's a history of the state, but also it tries to give you some tips on what to see or some tips on what you're looking at, things like that. It's for a general audience that's historically minded.
Yeah, and I even though I've lived, spent a good share of my life here in Wisconsin, I found I learned a fair amount too as I was reading the book. So it's not as though if you've lived in Wisconsin a long time, you're not going to get a lot out of the book.
Well, that's good.
That's for sure. Yeah. Well, Wisconsin-born novelist Edna Ferber once described Wisconsin as being little more than a snowy waste sprinkled with pines, Indian teepees, small inland lakes, and Milwaukee German breweries, all lying somewhere in that wilderness north of Chicago.
That's what she wrote.
That's quite a statement. And I guess, as you point out in the early, maybe in the preface, I forget exactly where it was, early in the book at least. Mm. There are a lot of people who have misconceptions about Wisconsin as a state. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of people view it as flyover country. That might not be so much true in the Midwest, but it certainly is true in other parts of the country. It's a big cow pasture. You see some trees and some cows and maybe some woods, and that's pretty much it. It's this feeling that nothing really has happened there very significantly, and that's clearly not true. Some very important people are from Wisconsin, have lived in Wisconsin. Some very important political trends have begun there and social trends as well. It's a state, I think, that's rich with culture and rich with history, and it's been very important for the development of the United States. And I think a lot of Wisconsinites don't always appreciate its significance either.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. You tell a funny story early on about talking with a friend or talking with someone and telling them that you were from Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, go ahead and tell that story.
Well, actually, I was in a basic training, actually. And you meet people from all different parts of the country, and, you know, the inevitable question comes up, where are you from? And I said, I was from Wisconsin, and someone said, oh, yeah, I've heard of that. What state is that in?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well.
So it is kind of a blank slate, I suppose, for a lot of people. There aren't a lot of concrete images that people have of Wisconsin other than perhaps the Packers.
Yeah.
The cheddar cheese hats, the things that I mentioned.
Yeah, the Packers and maybe the Brewers.
Well, this year, yeah.
Yeah, this year anyway. Well, in your organization of the book, your starting point is prehistoric Wisconsin, and you divide Wisconsin into two geological zones, including the Canadian Shield in northern Wisconsin. How important is that shield to the development of the state?
Well, it has a lot of mineral resources. I mean, mining has something that's been a very important part of Wisconsin history from the beginning. There is talk of mining up in the northern part of the state. So I think, you know, that's important.
And whether covered by ice or not, every part of Wisconsin, I think, was shaped by the ice age.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
Wisconsin, the last phase of glaciation, geologists know as the Wisconsin glaciation, because so many of the landforms you associate with glaciers are so prominent in Wisconsin. And in the book, I mentioned things like drumlins, for example. The state capital is located on top of a drumlin. There's the famous, if you're a geologist anyway, the famous Campbellsport drumlins in Fond du Lac County. The whole Kettle Moraine region, which is very beautiful, good for recreation, all of this was formed by the glaciers. And even the southwestern part of the state, which avoided glaciation, large amounts of wind-blown soil built up to help make that part of the state particularly good for agriculture. So, yeah, every corner of the state in some way or the other was affected by the glaciers.
You know, one of the things I liked about your book is that you list some sort of what you call must-see sites, including mm-hmm. Effigy mounds. The only surviving mound in the shape of a human figure is Man Mound?
The Man Mound, right.
At Baraboo's east side.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by the effigy mounds, you know, having grown up in Wisconsin. It is part of sort of an ancient history, I suppose you could say, of the state. In that prehistoric period, historic, of course, being before written records, it's something that's unique to Wisconsin as well, and it's sort of a great tragedy that most of them have been destroyed by farming, urban development, those sorts of things. They're really a unique part of Wisconsin history, really found only in Wisconsin and adjacent areas.
And we're, you know, kind of moving through the book a little bit, skipping back and forth, but Jean Nicolet, why was he sent to Lake Michigan where he landed just north? He landed north of Green Bay.
Most likely, I think.
Yeah, some people thought he had landed further north in Superior, I
believe. Right.
But tell that story a bit.
Well, all the European countries were in competition for resources, these sorts of things, and one of the things they were trying to do was get to China. Remember that Columbus was sailing to China and accidentally bumped into America. So one of the things they're also looking for, in addition to trading partners, in particular the fur trade in Wisconsin, they were looking for something called the Northwest Passage, which turns out doesn't actually exist, you know, unless the ice caps melt. There's no easy way by water to get around North America to Asia. So they're exploring around the Great Lakes, looking for fur trading opportunities, making contact with tribes in the area, but also hoping that they might bump into China somewhere or other. So they're exploring the area for a variety of reasons.
And as I think when he landed, didn't he even try to, he had some famous coat or whatever that he wore?
Well, this is one of those things that's really steeped in legend, and it makes a great story, and what actually happened isn't always very clear. But the story goes that he brought with him a Chinese robe made of silk so that he would be properly dressed when he came across his first Chinese businessman. And the story goes he got off the boat and he started shooting his pistols with his Chinese robe on. How much of that is true? How much of that is fiction? Again, it's something that's shrouded in mystery.
Where are the
great story, though?
Yeah, it is a great story. Where are the French forts in Wisconsin located?
Well, there was Fort Labaye, which is Green Bay, right near where the Neville Museum is, right downtown there mm-hmm. by the Nitschke Bridge. Fort Howard used to be there. The British had one there as well. There was another French fort up at Madeline Island. That was a very important meeting point, trading post, these sorts of things. So, if you go to Madeline Island, there had been a fort there as well. There was another one that was right on the shores of Lake Pepin. It's now sort of a highway rest area, and there's a marker there. Nothing from the fort exists anymore, but it gives you a really, really beautiful view of the river valley, Lake Pepin, the whole area. It was just a fantastically beautiful place. And at Prairie du Chien as well. Oh, Trempealeau as well. There was one at Trempealeau, what's now Perot State Park. And, of course, at Prairie du Chien, which was a very important place, historically speaking.
Yeah, you do a nice job, I think, of talking about, in your book, about the relationship between the natives, the Indians who were here and the fur trade, and then, of course, what followed mm-hmm. after. But talk a little bit about the relationship there between the French and maybe then the English and the Indians.
Sure. Well, when Europeans came, they didn't always treat the Native Americans very well. The Spanish, in particular, were known for being very harsh in the areas that they settled and conquered. The French found that to really get furs and in sufficient quantities, they needed the help of Native Americans. There were very few Frenchmen. They're in this very unusual environment for them. They don't know it. This is an animal that they're not really very familiar with. So there were French fur traders out there capturing the animals themselves, but they really needed the help of Native Americans and their trade contacts and their networks that really allowed the French to get access to furs in very deep parts of North America. So that was really more of a reciprocal, friendly relationship between the French and Native Americans than you oftentimes find with other European countries when they came here.
Yeah, and there were a lot of people who, there were some people who made an awful lot of money during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking ahead to your the piece that you wrote about the tanning and the leather industry mm-hmm. that developed. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, Wisconsin was a place where there were the tamarack trees and the things they needed to do leather tanning. Now, leather tanning usually involved cattle and those sorts of things quite a bit later, and not so much the furs that you found in the colonial period of Wisconsin history. But Wisconsin had a lot of farm animals. We needed to make boots and other sorts of things, and we had all the chemicals that we needed, basically, to tan the leather properly and turn it into something workable for shoes and boots and these kinds of things. So Milwaukee became one of the largest tanning centers in the world, in fact, at the time. The leather industry was something that was very important here in early Wisconsin history.
Yeah, it sure was. We're going to continue our talk with Mark Van Els, who is author of On the Road Histories, Wisconsin. It's published by Interlink Publishing. And we'll invite your questions and comments, too, as we move along here at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call or email us at talk@wpr.org. Taking a look at the historical, cultural, and geographic riches of the Badger State with Mark Van Els now. I'm Larry Mueller, and Mark Van Els is the author of On the Road Histories, Wisconsin, part of a series from Interlink Publishing. And he's done a nice job with this. He's an associate professor of history at Queensborough Community College of the City University of New York. And has this book just out, as a matter of fact. So I'm really pleased to have him with us today as we talk about the history of our state. And it's a very rich history, as we're learning here as we talk with him. If you'd like to join in, maybe you have a question or a comment about the state itself and its history and traditions, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, too. Oh, lots of emails come in at talk@wpr.org. And, Mark, we have a caller, Carol, on the line from Greendale, Wisconsin. So let's go right to Carol. Carol, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I am so glad to be able to ask this question. I have always been wondering what the syllable WAU means. It's in so many cities and towns in Wisconsin. And I wonder, it has to come from somewhere.
Well, like Waukesha or...
Right,
Milwaukee.
It goes on forever.
I don't know that. It's undoubtedly of Native American origin. It's probably of Algonquian, the linguistic family, but I don't know that offhand.
Somebody else might know that. Right. We'll see what we can come up with here, Carol.
Okay,
maybe,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Maybe we'll get an answer to that as we move along here today. And we're talking about famous people. But, Gary, well, before I go to that, let's go to Gary in Milwaukee, who has a question or comment for you. Gary, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I just got this question about the pyramids under Rock Lake, Wisconsin, the pyramids underwater there. How long did you know about those there?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah, the pyramids in Rock Lake. There are some pyramids that are under the water in Rock Lake. I'm trying to remember if you included anything on that in your book.
No, that doesn't sound familiar to me at all.
So that's something that I guess we can't help you with on that, Gary. But you do talk about, you spend a lot of time on the Native Americans that populated this state. We were talking earlier about the fur trade, and you take a little turn there at one point and say, when the fur trade died, then cooperation. Talk about what happened then with our natives.
Yeah, well, in terms of the fur trade, European fur traders or Euro-American fur traders oftentimes had a business partnership, essentially, with Native Americans, especially in the early days. They depended on Native Americans to get the furs and get access to a lot of furs. But once the fur trade began to decline, I mean, once the land began to open up for settlement, lumber and these sorts of things, once the fur trade shifted farther westward, that economic partnership then disintegrates. There's one thing that Americans want from Native Americans after this, and that's the land. Because they want to farm, and they want to mine, and they want to, you know, the lumber industry, and these sorts of things. And so that partnership, had already been essentially an unequal relationship to begin with.
Yeah.
And then that becomes even more distorted once the fur trade declines. So that's when the treaty sessions begin. This is when Native Americans begin to lose their land.
Yeah, and Lucen, and we had several tribes in Wisconsin, did we not?
Oh, sure. In the beginning, well, the Menominee are probably the oldest continuous residents of the state. Experts who've studied this suggest they probably have been here about 5,000 years. They have an origin story which originate. They're created in Wisconsin. They don't migrate from someplace else like a lot of other Native American origin stories are. Then you had the Ho-Chunk or the Winnebago in the far western part of the state. You had the Sioux Indians, which we think of today as being on the Great Plains. In fact, there was a band of Sioux Indians that lived in the northwestern part of the state as well. And then other tribes began to move in, particularly after in the 1600s, there was a war with the Iroquois, and that pushed a lot of tribes into Wisconsin, like the Potawatomi, let's say, the Sauk and Fox, other sorts of tribes as well. And the Ojibwe moved in right as Europeans were coming in. The Ojibwe were coming in from the east and moving into the northern Great Lakes region as well.
And the immigrants, of course, you spend some time talking about who those immigrants were from the countries.
Well, there were a lot of them.
Yeah. What was kind of interesting to me in your book, you mentioned the German, and of course we have a rich, and you know most state residents realize we have a very rich tradition, a German heritage here in the state. But when those folks were coming over as immigrants, they in some ways didn't think of themselves as Germans.
No, Germany was not a unified country until 1871. And even if you go to Germany today, there are still lots of regional distinctions the Germans even make between themselves, between Bavaria, let's say, and Pomerania, or what have you. So these people were not technically even German. They spoke the German language. They liked to eat schnitzel and things like this. But they were Bavarians and they were Pomeranians. And only when they came here were they really begin to see themselves as German, because they had a common culture that was different than the Native American, meaning, you know, Anglo-Saxon culture that was in this country. So that's really where a kind of German identity starts to develop with a lot of these immigrants who came to America. Now, this is also the time when German nationalism is beginning to rise in Europe. So, you know, they oftentimes had some sense of being German, but that really became solidified when they came to this country.
Yeah, and of course, so with the Germans and then the Irish and Norwegians in particular, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That mid part of the 1800s, Wisconsin had a remarkably diverse group of immigrants come to this country. As I say in the book, probably no place outside of New York City had a greater diversity. Lots of Germans, of course, from many different German areas. You had Swiss Germans coming as well, Belgians, and you had Dutch, and all kinds of others. Icelanders, Swedes, Norwegians, pretty much you name it. And any any part of that northwestern part of Europe had some people who ended up in Wisconsin, because these countries are the major source countries of immigration, just as the farmlands are being opened up in this country, just as Wisconsin is this frontier area. So it was a matter of timing, basically.
Yeah, timing. Frank in Arborvitae has a question or comment. Frank, hi.
Good morning. I wanted to ask somebody who is knowledgeable about the early history of Wisconsin this question for a long time. A while back, I got a library book that was written by, I can't tell you the name now, but it was an early writer on Wisconsin history. And in there, I was astonished to read a number of accounts about cannibalism amongst the Indians at that time. Do you know anything about this?
There are people who are far more expert in this sort of thing than I am. My understanding was that this would not be cannibalism, like eating people and harvesting people for food. You may have some ritualistic kind of cannibalism, like, say, for example, eating the heart of someone you've killed in a war or something like that. I don't know that much about that, and it sounds like a very controversial subject, and you probably want to direct that to someone more knowledgeable. My understanding is that such things did happen, but in a very limited fashion.
All right. Thanks, Frank. Jeff in Kenosha, we'll go to you next. Hi, thank you for calling, Jeff.
Love the program, and I have a very quick question. I was at a fur trading camp. I'm going to say it was in the Cable, Wisconsin area, or within 45 minutes of there, and it started with the letter F, and it was a French name, where they kind of... It's a reworked camp. They train you on different things. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah. My French is very bad. I had one semester. Foie Avant, I think it's pronounced. F-O-L-L-E-A-V-O-I-N-S. It means wild rice in French. This is a reconstructed fur trade settlement. It's in Danbury, Wisconsin.
There you go. There you go. That's a great place.
Now, there's also the there's the rendezvous at Prairie du Chien, which is very popular as well. So there are things like that out there.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You mentioned you have a great picture of the famous Milton House in the village of Milton in Rock County, and you tell the story of Joseph Goodrich. That was a famous stop on the Underground Railroad. Talk a little about that.
Right. This was the years, of course, before the Civil War. Wisconsin was, that part of the state in particular, was populated by a lot of people who were known as Yankees. Now, these are the people from upstate New York, New England, areas like this. And many of them were very strongly anti-slavery, largely on religious grounds and moral grounds. Now, the way American law worked at the time was that if you were a slave in a southern state, like, let's say, Alabama, Mississippi, if you escaped to the north, you were still a slave under the law. You were subject to being recaptured, and in fact, there were rewards if you turned in a runaway slave, and if you harbored a runaway slave, you were guilty of a crime. And yet these people felt so strongly that slavery was wrong that they wanted to help these people escape, typically to Canada, which was then British, and they would be outside of American law. So they had this underground railroad where these abolitionists, these people who wanted to get rid of slavery, they would spirit people from one place to another in an effort to try to get them out of the country. And the Milton House was apparently one of these stops on the Underground Railroad. Now, as I mentioned in the book, these sites are very difficult to document. Criminals don't normally keep track of keep good records, right? So proving the existence of these sorts of things is oftentimes very, very difficult. But the Milton House is one that seems to be pretty well established as a stop on the Underground Railroad. So there was an inn for, you know, travelers, but in the basement at night they would keep runaway slaves down there, and then at night spirit them to the next location.
You know, the picture that you have in there of the Milton House reminded me of the expert photography. You know, that's an old photo, and you've got many, many old photos, and the clarity of these photos. I happen to be looking right now. I have the old picture of Old Abe.
Yeah.
The eagle. It's just astoundingly sharp and clear.
Oh, sure. And they had to stay still because photo technology, those are very sharp pictures, but people had to stay still in order to make it that clear. So how they kept Old Abe still that long, I don't know.
Yeah, but just a general comment, the photography that the photos that you have in the book, which you have many photos, mm-hmm. are all wonderfully clear and crisp.
Well, I selected some, but the editors of at the publisher selected a lot of them as well. So I'm only partially responsible for that.
Well,
I didn't take the pictures.
Oh man, I tell you, I know you didn't take the pictures, but I tell you what, the publisher did a really nice job on those photos as well.
Oh, I've got to agree. Yeah.
Let's see. We have Jesse in Deer Park wondered if you had written any about fox farming in Wisconsin, particularly the silver fox farms of the Fromm family. I don't recall.
No, I don't know anything about that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't have any recollection of me having anything on that. You do write about the Civil War and Wisconsin's role in the Civil War, which was considerable.
Sure. We were a new state. I mean, we were admitted to the Union in 1848, just as the big sectional crisis began to emerge. So even though we were really pretty small and we were really pretty distant, we sent our fair share of soldiers to go fight. Wisconsin soldiers fought in every southern state except for Florida, participated in most of the great battles of the Civil War. There's the famous Iron Brigade, for example, the 2nd Wisconsin, 6th and 7th, combined with a regiment from Michigan and Indiana. They were at places like Antietam. If you go to the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison, there's a diorama. Maybe you've been there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful. And a great history. And the camps, you have a listing of the various camps around the state that existed, too. Did we lose? Are you there, Mark? Oh, we might have lost Mark. Let's see if we can get him back here. Mark Van Els is our guest today, a native of our state, and has written the book On the Road Histories, Wisconsin. And having some fun talking with him, he starts way back in prehistoric times and takes us and this is in about 215-20 pages, takes us through some of the really colorful history and interesting history and looks at our cultural and geographic riches as well in the book. So it's really wonderful to have. And it's a kind of book that you can use, give to if read yourself for just for the enjoyment and some of the things you'll know and some of the things you won't know. But he does a fine job of it, and really the worth of the book, not only for Wisconsin residents, but really for those who are coming to visit Wisconsin. It's a kind of a nice book, part of this whole series of histories of various states. And so it's something you can take with you or when you visit. I'm sure there are other ones of other states you can take with you when you visit another state. So it's really really a pleasure to have him with us today. And I'm sorry that we're kind of losing. I think we're trying to get him back here, and I'm not sure exactly what happened. But we'll find out here, and we'll keep trying, and we'll see if we can come up with him. He does a nice profile of Golda Meir, who once called Milwaukee home. You know, she ran away from home. What was she, 15 years old, something like that? And she went to live with her older sister in Denver, but her parents talked her into coming back to back home the following year, and tells that story about how she rose to become the prime minister of Israel in 1968. So That's one of the stories that you're going to find in there, in addition to the history that of the state that he includes. Just to let you know kind of how this goes, he talks about the Gilded Age of Wisconsin, where we sort of become America's Dairyland. And he then talks about you know, that was kind of a tough time in our state's history back in that what they call the Gilded Age. I guess it was a tough time across the country because it was at that time that there was a lot of graft and so forth going on. And we've got him. Yeah, Mark, you back there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, we've got you back.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. I was just talking about the coverage that you had in there of the Gilded Age of Wisconsin. That was a kind of an interesting time all across the country, but certainly in Wisconsin as well. Talk about what that was like in Wisconsin.
Well, that's really when industrialization, for example, begins to take root in the state. So the very nature of the economy starts to change. It becomes much more diversified. So places like Milwaukee, of course, the Fox Valley, Racine, Kenosha, and such become pretty important industrial centers. Milwaukee in particular, the Fox Valley becomes known for many of the industries that we are familiar to us today that have made Wisconsin famous really begin at this time. This is also when dairy becomes the keystone of agricultural world. Before the Civil War, it was largely wheat.
Yeah.
And it's after the Civil War that America, Wisconsin first becomes America's Dairyland. So it's a very, very formative period, not just, as you said, in American history, but for Wisconsin as we know it today.
Yeah, and that was probably around the 1870s, and there it was 1860s, 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's correct. That whole period it was a gradual transition that began to take place. I mean, people did have a sense at the time that the world is changing very rapidly. But again, as I said, that is the Wisconsin we know and love really takes shape during that period.
And that was kind of the time, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, where the Republicans really dominated Wisconsin politics.
Yeah, Republicans dominated Wisconsin politics from the Civil War through much of the 20th century. In fact, it's not until after World War II that the Democrats really become competitive. Now, what Wisconsin did have for a while in the 20th century was the Progressive Party. And once the Progressive Party collapses after World War II, many of those people who had been Republicans, La Follette, for example, was a Progressive Republican, his political descendants then migrate into the Democratic Party after World War II, and that's when real competition Wisconsin returns, and the political atmosphere that we have today takes shape then.
Yeah, it sure does. Well, while we were off you were off air there, I mentioned that you profiled Golda Meir, who had left home, came back. How did she manage to rise to become Prime Minister of Israel?
She was a very skilled politician. She was very dedicated to the state of Israel. She was born in Ukraine, moved to Milwaukee as a girl, and then became involved in the Zionist movement. And well before the state of Israel was created, she went to what was then Palestine. So she was there at the beginning of Israel, modern-day Israel. So she was being involved in the beginning, of course. She worked her way up through the political system to become the prime minister in the early 1970s. And during the Arab-Israeli War of 1973, she was the prime minister.
And you take us right through, there were some interesting pieces that you have in here on the wars and on, oh my goodness, some of the troubles in Father James Groppi. I was reminded of him in your, as I read through your book. So it, an interesting time and a book well worth picking up. Mark, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
My great pleasure.
Thank you. Mark Van Els is the proper name there. He's a native of our state. Has his PhD in history from the UW-Madison and is the author of On the Road Histories, Wisconsin. It's published by Interlink Publishing. I'm really pleased to have him with us today to talk about his book. And let's look ahead a little bit to see what we've got coming up tomorrow at 11. We're going to be celebrating 4-H. Tim Tallon of Sheboygan. And we've got a couple of 4-H members, Jim Klopotic and Claire Oman will be our guest to talk about 4-H and celebrating it. I was a 4-H'er, and so I kind of like 4-H. And then at 11:45, we'll have the president of Virent Energy Systems of Madison to talk about biofuel research. There's a lot of good stuff going on there, too. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.